Chapter 20, Retooling the Template. The Exodus event, the deliverance from bondage in Egypt, was the catalyst for Israel's transition from a people to a nation. Any good commentary or guide to the Bible will flag that, but there's a good deal more going on. Over the next three chapters, we'll see that events shortly after the Exodus hark back to Eden and the Divine Council backdrop in some amazing ways. God's Edenic vision began with his announcement that humankind was his image. Yahweh had divine sons. He would also have a human family. Genesis told us that God had a divine council of imagers who represented his authority in the unseen realm and participated in his rule. It also shows us that God planned a mirror council on earth, this time composed of human imagers. These two family administrations were together in his presence. Heaven had come to earth at Eden. Humanity was charged with extending the earthly presence and rule of God throughout the whole earth. God wanted to live and rule with all his children in his new creation. Genesis 3 through 11 makes it clear that humanity failed miserably. Free will in the hands of imperfect beings comes with that risk. But the incident at Babel, foolish and self-willed as it was, shows us that there's an Edenic yearning in the human heart, a desire for utopia, and a sense of divine presence. But God would not trade his own version of Eden for humanity's. He punished the nations with disinheritance. He would create a new people as his own portion. That inheritance was begun in covenant with Abraham and passed on through his family. God delivered that family from bondage under Moses. Egypt and its gods were defeated. What was corrupted in Eden and counterfeited in the days of the flood and Babel was quickened to life on the other side of the waters of chaos. Israel is my son. Yahweh's perception of Israel is clear. Israel is my son, my firstborn. Exodus 4:22. Out of Egypt I called my son, Hosea 11:1. As Abraham, Yahweh's portion, Deuteronomy 32:9, has been the new Adam. So Israel, the collective progeny of Abraham, was also the new Adam. Adam was Yahweh's son. Israel was Yahweh's son. That may not seem profound, but it is. Once you realize that this pattern continues through the remainder of the Bible, the messaging becomes clear. Eventually, God will refer to the king of Israel as his son, Psalm 2:7. The ultimate future king, the Messiah, since he will sit on the seat of David, must be Yahweh's son as well. And since we glorified believers will sit on that throne too, sharing that rule, Revelation 3:21, we are God's sons, his children. Every believer is also Abraham's offspring by faith. Galatians 3:26-29. We are the current and eschatological sons of God. Our status began with Adam, was rescued in Abraham, and was fulfilled in Jesus, heir to David's throne. These connections are actually among the more obvious. There is more that extends from Israel's sonship all the way to our glory. Believing Israel, God's earthly council. Recall that in our discussion of Deuteronomy 32:8-9, I mentioned that the number of nations disinherited by Yahweh at the judgment of Babel was 70. The number is telling. Israel's nearest religious competition, the worship of El, Baal, Asherah, at Ugarit, and in Canaan, held that their divine council had 70 sons. When Yahweh disinherited the nations and allotted them to the sons of God, a theological gauntlet was thrown down. Yahweh alone commands the nations and their gods. Other gods serve him. The Exodus story follows that theological punch in the nose with another. Not only is Israel Yahweh's son and portion on earth, but Israel is to be governed by a special group of 70 under Moses, and later the Israelite king, who was Yahweh's and Troll's son. Shortly after crossing through the sea, Moses and Israel encounter Jethro. The account is recorded in Exodus 18. Seeing the throngs, Jethro advises Moses to select men to help him govern the people. No number is given in that passage, but later, in Exodus 24, we read, "And to Moses, he, Yahweh, said, Go up to Yahweh, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 from the elders of Israel, and you will worship at a distance. And Moses alone will come near to Yahweh, and they will not come near, and the people will not go up with him. And Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 from the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel, and what was under his feet was like a sapphire tilework, and like the very heavens for clearness." Exodus 24, 1, 2, 9 through, and 10. The wording suggests that these 70 elders were drawn from a larger group, as were the Elohim of Yahweh's council, who were given different ranks and tasks. Not every member of the divine council has equal rank. The sons of God, with authority over the nations, were assigned that role, but they became corrupt and are the object of the sentencing of Psalm 82. The correspondences are deliberate. The 70 nations were placed under the dominion of lesser gods in the wake of Yahweh's judgment of the nations at the Tower of Babel. Yahweh's own kingdom is structured with a single leader, Moses for now, with whom he speaks directly, in a council of 70. Historically, this leadership structure would continue into Jesus' day as the Jewish Sanhedrin, led by the high priest, number 70. We're more interested in the theological messaging. In terms of the biblical theology, the imagery has a distinct meaning. God is starting his intended Edenic rule with Israel. Israel will have a single earthly leader, eventually the Messianic king, the ultimate offspring of Eve, and a council of 70. The number telegraphs that as the kingdom of God is reestablished on earth, the 70 nations will be reclaimed, a process that begins with the ministry of Jesus and will continue to the end of days. The ultimate outcome of the reclaiming of nations under Yahweh is suggested in passages that transparently relate to the divine council. Loyal members of Yahweh's council are themselves referred to as his elders in Isaiah 24:23, the context of which is clearly eschatological. On that day, the Lord will punish the host of heaven in heaven and the kings of the earth on the earth, when the moon will be confounded and the sun ashamed, for the Lord of hosts reigns on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders. That setting makes sense given the divine council scene of Revelation 4:5, where the 24 elders surround God's throne. The teaching point is profound. The corrupt sons of God who currently dominate the nations will be replaced by loyal members of God's family. But which family? The New Testament explains that. Heirs of the cosmos. Since the church, the corporate body of believers, inherited the promises given to Abraham, Galatians 3:26-29, believers are the true Israel. The New Testament talks about when we inherit rule of the nations with Jesus at the end of days, Revelation 3:21, we will displace the corrupt divine sons of God presently ruling the nations who are under judgment, Psalm 82. We are already, but not yet, Yahweh's new council on earth. The Apostle John captures the spirit of the point. But as many as receive him, to those who believe in his name, he gave them authority to become children of God, John 1:12. See what sort of love the Father has given to us, that we should be called children of God, and we are, 1 John 3:1. The structuring helps us make sense of something else Paul said. The rulership of the nations was a higher ranking task than being a messenger, the meaning of the word angel. The destiny of believers, who will share Jesus' throne, and the rule of nations as a backdrop for Paul's statement that Christians should stop letting the world's courts resolve their disputes. In 1 Corinthians 6:3, he protests, "Do you not know that we will judge angels? When we are made divine, glorified on the new earth, we will outrank angels." Believers are God's once and future family, once and future council, once and future rulers with Jesus over all the nations. Israel's release propels this theology. The glorified divine aspect of Yahweh's human family council is telegraphed in other ways. The divine sons of God are called the morning stars in Job 38:7, and the stars of God in Isaiah 14:13. The imagery of Joseph's dream where the sons of Jacob, Israel, are stars, Genesis 37:9, is no accident. Neither is it a coincidence that Abraham's offspring will be as the stars. While that phrase speaks of a numerical multitude of offspring, that isn't its only message. Star language speaks of divinity or glorification elsewhere. In Revelation, Jesus himself, the morning star, and angels are identified with star language to denote their divine, non-earthly nature. Revelations 1:20, 22:16, and 2:28. As Daniel says, the righteous will shine like the brightness of the sky above, like the stars forever and ever. In Daniel 12, 2, 3. Our inheritance of the nation with Jesus at the end of days, Revelation 3:21, is in a glorified, resurrected, divine state. The star language of Genesis 15 has an eschatological connotation. In Romans, Paul was tracking on this idea. Scholars have noticed with interest that his slight change of the language of Genesis 15, God's promises to Abraham in Romans 4. In Genesis 15:5, the embodied Yahweh brought Abraham outside and said, "Look toward the heavens and count the stars if you are able to count them." And he said to him, "So shall your offspring be." Paul refers to the verse twice in Romans 4. So that Abraham became the father of many nations, according to what was said, "So will your descendants be," Romans 4:18. For the promise to Abraham, or to his descendants, that he would be heir of the world, Greek cosmos, was not through the law, but through the righteousness by faith, Romans 4:13. A few observations are in order. For Paul, Abraham did not become the father of just Israel, but of many nations. The point, of course, harks back to his theology in Galatians 3, where all believers, Jew or Gentile, are Abraham's seed. Galatians 3, 26-29. The notion of Abraham's offspring becoming heir of the world speaks to rulership of the nations by those offspring. The corrupt divine sons of God of Deuteronomy 32:8 would be displaced by new divine sons of God, glorified believers. Paul's logic makes sense if believers are Yahweh's children, especially given the merging of humanity with the divine presence back in Eden. Even now we are sharers of the divine nature, 2 Peter 1:4. But one day we will be made like Jesus, 1 John 3:1-3, 1 Corinthians 15:35-49. And rule with him over the nations. Believers, the spiritual offspring of Abraham, will ultimately reverse the disinheritance of nations along with the curse of death that extended from Eden's failure. Eden and Sinai. In Genesis, Eden was Yahweh's home and the meeting place of his divine council. God has since changed addresses. Sinai was now his domain, and where Israel was now headed. Earlier, we discovered that Eden was the dwelling place and headquarters of the divine council. We were reminded of the description of Eden in Genesis as a lush garden with four rivers, Genesis 10:2-14. Eden was also a mountain, Ezekiel 28:13-14, the administrative seat of the gods, Ezekiel 28:2. Situated in the heart of the sea, Ezekiel 28:2, and a description that reiterated the well-watered imagery of the council headquarters. The gods lived in the best or most remote places. That earlier discussion noted some connection between Eden and Mount Zion. It's time to take a look at the connection with Sinai. The fact that Eden is referred to as both a garden and a mountain in Ezekiel 28:13-14 is significant. It provides a clear conceptual link between Eden and the holy mountain of God, Sinai. We've actually already gotten a hint that Sinai is God's home and meeting place in the passage about the 70 elders, Exodus 24:9-11. Yahweh appeared in human form, as he had to the patriarchs and Moses. But this time, the 70 earthly elders are along for the meeting. The council room has been reserved for the 70 from Israel. Sinai, as Yahweh's throne room, is telegraphed in other ways. Exodus 24 notes that Yahweh was seated and that under his feet was a pavement of shining sapphire stone, like the very heavens for clearness, Exodus 24:10. Again, light speaks of divine presence. This imagery is repeated in other passages and expanded to include fire, smoke, flashing light, lightning, and loud noises. Exodus 19:16, 18, 20:18, Deuteronomy 5:4-5, and 22-26. All of these elements are found in familiar visions of Yahweh on his throne. Isaiah 6, Ezekiel 1, Daniel 7, Psalm 18. These passages employ the same imagery whether Yahweh is enthroned in the spiritual realm or on earth. Heaven and earth are connected. Yahweh rules both. Some of these passages have the divine council, the heavenly host, present. That's to be expected in view of other Eden-Sinai connections. For example, in the throne room scene of Daniel 7, we read, "As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000,000 served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened." Verses 9 and 10. This is one of the more explicit divine council texts in the Old Testament. There are multiple thrones in this heavenly scene, along with the single throne occupied by the Ancient of Days, the God of Israel. There is a clear reference to the council. The word translated court here refers to a judicial body. There's another fascinating Sinai passage that links the divine council to the mountain and also to the thing that the mountain is perhaps best known for, the giving of the law. That might sound odd. In my experience, most people have Charlton Heston in their mind's eye when you bring up Sinai and the law. And there aren't any angels in that scene. But if the divine council isn't associated with the law, how do we handle verses like these? "Which of the prophets did your fathers not prosecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered, you who received the laws delivered by angels and did not keep it." Acts 7:52-53. "Therefore, we must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. For since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable, and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation?" Hebrews 2:1-3. The law delivered by angels? Hollywood wasn't exactly following the biblical script very closely. We'll set the record straight in the next chapter.